Right, Michael, thank you. This is Michael Nicholson, and it's Reel 14. When did you first go to Vietnam, Michael?
1969. It was the aftermath of the Tet Offensive. You know, the war started proper with the landing of the American troops in Da Nang in 64. You have to check the date. I think it's 64. They landed with, you know, rather like the way they landed in Somalia with a great razzmatazz. But that was the first arrival of the massive forces. And in 1969, the Viet Cong, which we called them the VC, Charlie, the Americans called them Charlie, which were the South Vietnamese guerrillas supporting the North Vietnamese, all communists. But people got very confused. There was the North Vietnamese Army operating from Hanoi in the north, and there was the Viet Cong, the VC, Charlie, who was the South Vietnamese communist, working as a guerrilla army under the direction of the North Vietnamese Communist Army. A lot of people got very confused about it. And in 1968, the Viet Cong, orchestrated by the North Vietnamese, launched a guerrilla attack on a number of American air bases. And most spectacular of all was an attack right into the heart of Saigon at the American embassy. And the combined operation across the whole of South Vietnam, from Hue right the way down to My Tho in the delta, from Vung Tau in the east right across to Cu Chi on the Cambodian border, the Viet Cong launched these sporadic guerrilla attacks. It was called Tet. It was a Vietnamese anniversary. And it was devastating. They actually got inside the American embassy and did enormous damage. But it was a defeat by the for the Viet Cong, because they were defeated by the Americans. They lost about 6,000 to 8,000 men. The Americans lost 4,000. But of course, in military terms, to be attacked the way they were by such a small band of people, you know, totally undermine the credibility of the Americans. And I suppose really from then on, the American army, as well as the American public back home, realized that what was coming out of Vietnam via the American forces information service did not actually match what was actually happening there. So of course I went there in 69 on the anniversary of Tet in February 69. Tet didn't happen on a special day. It all depended on the moon, I think. But it was in February, and everyone was expecting a repeat. The Vietnamese, like all Asians, are very fond of anniversaries, and they tend to, if they're going to do something spectacular, they will do it on an anniversary. And so we were all expecting, and sure enough, I got there, and I remember that night. I just arrived in that morning, but despite the jet lag, full of enthusiasm, you know, this was my first major foreign war, and to be sent to Vietnam by your company was, you know, something of a privilege. It was something everybody wanted. And I stood on the roof of the Caravelle Hotel, and that morning there'd been some 122 millimeter rockets in, and they'd caused a bit of damage in the center of Saigon. And as I was describing these rockets and what they did, suddenly we heard and they came over our heads. Didn't see them, of course, because they travelled so far, but we heard it, and we felt them. And sure enough, over our heads, and they fell in the street just below us. So that was my first introduction to Vietnam, but not my last meeting with 122 millimeter rockets. We would have quite a few of them fired near and around us for the next all the years I remained in Vietnam. So that was my first introduction. My first introduction to, well, how can I describe it? The imbecility of the American Army operation was, Well, let me know. Let me tell you first about my first operation in Vietnam, which almost convinced me that I ought not to be there at all. I consider myself, having been to Nigeria, having done a little bit in Biafra, and having seen a little bit of action elsewhere, I thought that I was, you know, a veteran war reporter. But my first operation in Vietnam was with, it's called the River Marine Patrol. It's tiny little plastic fiberglass boats with a machine gun at one end and a searchlight. And what they did was to go around the delta, the Mekong Delta in the south, patrolling, often boarding junks to see whether they were carrying supplies or Viet Cong. I don't know if you've ever seen the film Apocalypse Now, but there is a scene in there where you see this little river marine patrol with a big black staff sergeant at the back in charge, and guys kind of lolling about. Well, that's exactly how it was. Now, when the river is wide, you feel fairly safe. But when you go off into one of the tributaries, which are probably only 30 or 40 yards across, and the tall trees and the dense jungle, where anything that moves you're convinced is a Viet Cong about to open fire, I began to feel incredibly nervous. So much so that, I was, I think, shaking slightly. But everybody else on board the boat seemed to be very relaxed. The big black staff sergeant was kind of humming, I don't know, probably Old Man River, but he was humming his song. There were a couple of guys on the front who were picking little bits of shrapnel, splinters of some previous operation out of their arms. My crew were very relaxed. They were just sitting there kind of talking. And I said to myself, well, Nick, you're in the wrong business. I mean, if you can't take this, you know, how are you going to endure weeks, months, years in Vietnam? I mean, it was a moment of truth. Until I suddenly saw people popping little tablets into their mouth. And I realized that I was the only sober guy on the boat. All the others were taking pills, drugs, which was, of course, the story of Vietnam, an astonishing number, amazing percentage of soldiers and airmen of the American Army, American services were high on drugs for so much of the time. But that was my first experience of Vietnam, going out on a river marine patrol. We boarded vessels, we did what they did in the film Apocalypse Now. I didn't shoot anybody, but it was very brutal. But my first big operation was with Colonel Patton. He was the famous son of the famous father. And I think, like a lot of sons, he tried to act out his father's role. Big man like his father, handsome, carried his father's own, I think they were ivory butts, handles, Colts, you know, kind of Western pistols, not the standard American pistol. And we went out on this enormous tank operation. Now, this tank operation was close to what's called the Parrot's Peak. It's, if you look at the map of Vietnam, Cambodia, it's close to the Cambodian border, and it looks like a parrot's beak, a bit like my nose. It was the end of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Now, you know, the Ho Chi Minh Trail was this journey that the North Vietnamese army had to take from the north, from Hanoi, all the way down the Vietnam, Laos, Cambodian border to take troops and supplies down to the south. A lot of it was, of course, through dense jungle, some of it was through tunnels, some through open roads. The Americans were not officially at war in Cambodia or in Laos, but somehow they had to disrupt the supply route. And this tank operation was apparently designed to do that. Before on the way there, towards these huge Michelin rubber plantations, I mean, they are huge. And if you've ever seen one, it is a start. They're like regimented trees. They're all set so many meters apart. And I suddenly came across an area which had been totally flattened. And this, again, was my first experience of B-52 bombing. I'd heard about the B-52 saturation bombing, carpet bombing, as it's called. I'd never seen any evidence of it. And these huge bombers, still being used today in Afghanistan, carry tons and tons. I mean, I think somebody said 60 tons. I can't believe any aircraft can carry 60 tons of bombs. But they just drop them in a line, and it devastates. And the devastation has to be seen to be believed. Hundreds and hundreds of acres of trees just flattened. It looked like something out of the pictures we remember of Ypres and Passchendaele. So off we went into this huge tank convoy. By huge, I mean, 30 or 40 tanks, all in line, crashing through this Michelin rubber plantation, doing as much damage as the B-52s. I learned later that the Michelin rubber company, a French company, got so many cents for every tree that was destroyed. So they were making a pretty good profit even out of the war then. I was told that this was the biggest tank operation of the war so far, and this was in 69, remember. And Colonel Patton sat on the top of his tank, leading the column. And even then I thought, if they're trying to catch guerrillas, if they're trying to catch a secret army, how on earth do you expect to do it with 30 or 40 tanks making the kind of noise that could be heard in that kind of area, 5, 6, 10 miles away? But, this was the way the Americans operated and probably still do. The great show of force, let's scare the wits out of these people and they'll never come back. That night, the first night, we stopped. And what the Americans do, it's a bit like the old South African lager or the Wild West cowboys do. When you stop at night, you ring your covered wagons in a circle. And this is what the Americans do. They ringed their tanks in a large circle with their guns pointing out, and then they camp inside it. This is what we did. And during the night, we're bedded down under a tank in our sleeping bags, and suddenly there's this fire. Somebody opens fire, and we recognized the sound of an AK-47 has a very distinctive crack, like no other gun in the world. It was soon over. There was a bit of return fire, and we went back to sleep. Then, just before it got dawn, there was another bit of firefighting, and by this time, of course, it was getting light. We were awake, and we got out to investigate with our camera. And it turned out that during the night, some Viet Cong, we'd actually parked over a tunnel complex. Now, you know that the Viet Cong devised this astonishing tunnel complex. They actually lived in tunnels. Cu Chi was the most famous. We weren't very far from Cu Chi. But they actually dug 10 feet, 15 feet underground, and just like a mole, excavated a whole tunnel complex in which they lived and operated from. It was their underground headquarters. They had their hospitals there, their kitchens, their schoolrooms. I mean, I met people later who were conceived in these tunnels and were born in these tunnels and grew up in these tunnels, only seeing, well, not daylight, but only seeing the world during the night when they were allowed, a bit like a mole, I suppose, to come to the surface and breathe fresh air. But I met one girl who'd spent 15 years living in tunnels. She'd been conceived and born there and grew up there. And had the war had ended sooner, she probably would have had her own children there. So we had actually parked over one of these tunnel complexes. And during the night, some of these Viet Cong came out and opened fire with AK-47s, these small caliber automatic rifles, against tanks. Of course, they were quickly wiped out. And as I said, at dawn, some more came out and opened fire and were quickly wiped out. So then General Patton decided that he would send one of his own men down into these tunnel complexes to destroy what was left. Now, these guys were called tunnel rats. The Americans, nickname for them, were called tunnel rats. And astonishingly brave, suicidal men. Very small men, quite often kind of Mexican-looking, Filipino-looking, very small, dark, swarthy men who would have no problems like the usual big 6-foot-6 Marine in getting into these tunnels, same size as the Vietnamese. So they sent one of them, we filmed and sent one of these tunnel rats down into the complex with his pistol, and a few minutes later we heard a crack, and we knew it wasn't a pistol fire, so obviously the tunnel rat had been killed. So then Patton decides that he's going to smoke them out, and then they actually put down phosphorus bombs, these phosphorus grenades, which, when they explode, just send out this phosphorus, white-hot phosphorus flame and heat, which burns everything. Incredible, it's like napalm. And not satisfied with that, he decided to send in his earth movers, and every tank squadron has one or two earth movers in case a tank gets stuck in the mud and they can actually pull them out, dig them out. So he put in this bulldozer with the earth scooper in front and scooped up. Eventually, out of all this mud and cake were more bodies, but they were dead. And you know, the astonishing thing was that these bodies were all crouched, all came out, and we got pictures, we filmed them. I don't think they were ever shown on television. But these bodies had been dead some days, and they were in that kind of rigor mortis state, and they were all crouched up in a fetal position, with they're up like this, and their hands over their ears, and that's how they were dragged down. And we couldn't make it out, and we were told that they'd all died from concussion from the B-52 strikes. The enormity of the bombing raids kind of went through the tunnels, and they were concussed. And there was blood from their nose and their ears and things, and that's how they were dragged out. And one man, I always remember, they dragged out one guy whose stomach had blown open, and all his entrails were out. These American troops, 18, 19-year-olds, stripped to the waist, because it's incredibly hot there, sat down within yards of these bodies, stinking bodies, scooping their breakfast out of their mess tins. it was astonishing, but it gave me my first impression and my first tinge of reluctant respect for an enemy who, instead of keeping quiet down there until the Americans moved on, felt it their duty to come out of their hiding holes and attack this enormous force of tanks. I mean, call them idiots, but, what dedication, what sacrifice. We also had Vietnam was a succession of unbelievable things. I mean, any movie you see about Vietnam, and there have been plenty of movies about Vietnam, seems to be exactly right. I mean, even Apocalypse Now, despite the fantasy at the end, so much of it was true. And to this day, I never quite know, it's chicken and egg. What came first? Was it Hollywood that decided how men should act in Vietnam, or did Hollywood really just simply repeat what was happening in Vietnam? We came across a character that could have been straight out of Apocalypse Now. He may well have been the person in the film might well have been based upon this man, and we called him. He was nicknamed Colonel Kong. He was an American colonel, and he lived in a camp. Commanded a camp, a very small camp, just near Cu Chi, in the west of Vietnam, towards the Cambodian border, and. We visited him. I forget the reason why now. Maybe it was just one of these operations that we were allocated. And he treated us to lunch. We had a super lunch, astonishing lunch, and wine. Apparently this guy took his own chef, a Thai chef, with him wherever he went, and also had French wine sent in. He was... he had doctorates in philosophy, and I mean, he was a very well-educated guy. Incredibly well spoken. It reminded me of Fonda, the actor.
Henry
Fonda. It reminded me of Henry Fonda. Very quiet, gentle guy. And we interviewed him. I don't think we ever used the interview, but I mean, we're there, so we interviewed him. And he said, "Right, I'm thank you, gentlemen, and you know, we'll arrange a helicopter to see you back to Saigon. And I'm now off to hunt Kong." And we said, "You mean you're off on an operation to hunt the Viet Cong?" "Oh, no," he said, I'm going off just to hunt a Kong on my own." We said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, every afternoon after lunch, if there's nothing happening and no duties to be done, I get in my helicopter with my hunting rifle." He had a hunting rifle. And he went up, and he said this quite openly, without any sense of guilt. And he went up in this little small two-seater Bell helicopter, little bubble glass helicopter, and he looked for somebody out there, whether it was a woman sowing rice or somebody herding cattle or an old man just finding his way home, and he would chase them in his helicopter and hunt them. And then he would kill them. He would shoot them. And he would come back to base and get on with his administrative duties. All of which we simply could not believe. Because... you know, Americans, especially when the press is around, is, if you excuse the word, full of shit. And we thought this man was just full of shit. But the helicopter pilot who took us back to Saigon, one of his own pilots, said, "Sure, I know, he does it every afternoon." And he came up with this quote, which in a movie, I mean, it should be in any movie about Vietnam, the helicopter pilot said, he said, "You've got to do something around here," he said. "Otherwise, you'd just go crazy." So, you know, that was the oddest thing about the Vietnam War. It's unlike any other war that I think they've ever covered. It was the ideal package to a war for, you know, for the communicator. You couldn't have it better. If you wanted to go to war, you rang up the PIO, the American Press Information Officer, and said, "Look, what do you got on?" He'd say, "Well, we're doing this there, and we're doing that there. Which one do you want?" We'd say, "Well, how, you know, can we do that?" "Fine, we'll be at Tonson Nude Airport in the morning at 0700 hours, and there'll be a Lieutenant MacArthur waiting for you, and off you go." And you'd go off for a few days, you'd film the war, you'd do your story, see all the action you wanted, and then the helicopter, whenever you wanted, you almost had to snap your fingers and there'd be a helicopter to take you back to Saigon. And you would go back to your air-conditioned hotel, you'd pull your filthy, dirty clothes off, chuck them to the room boy, you'd have your shower, you'd have your first drink, and then you'd go off to, well, there were a variety of wonderful restaurants in Saigon, all French restaurants. Romancho's was our favorite, just across Lam Song Square. And you'd have a slap-up, you know, wonderful meal and French wine. It was almost as if Saigon itself was insulated from the war, which it was, except for those few occasions when the Viet Cong infiltrated, like in the embassy, when they attacked Cholon, the occasional 122mm rocket coming in. Saigon, it's almost as if it just turned its back on the war. A lot of Americans, when they were doing R&R, which is their rest and recuperation kind of leave, would go to Bangkok or Hong Kong. A lot of them would just stay in Saigon because everything they wanted was there. You know, you could, as I say, you could have your salad niçoise in Romanches. You could go to any one of the nightclubs there, hundreds of nightclubs, you know, with all the beautiful dolly girls. And believe me, the Vietnamese girls are among the most gorgeous in the world. And, you know, for $5 you have a body. And as somebody said, save the other $20 for the doctor. You could go to any number of, how can we call it, clubs of great diversity, you know, where you'd have the most beautiful looking creature with a bulging jockstrap. So whatever you wanted, it was there. The officers lived over at the Rex Hotel, near the town hall, the Hotel de Ville. The Rex Hotel was just for officers. It had its own bar and it had its own swimming pool, of course, which was very, very popular with the officers. And there was a hotel down at Tudor. Tudor was the kind of main drag downtown Saigon, where all the bars were and the brothels and the casinos and things. And because there were so many Americans, they started to build hotels, you know, really quickly. You could put up a hotel in a week kind of thing, you know, they were that fast. And this the very thin, tall hotel, which had probably been built in half an hour, decided it too would have a swimming pool. And so it built a swimming pool on the top floor, which they thought would make them a fortune. And then they filled it up with water. And like a bath coming through a ceiling, it went through the whole middle of the hotel. It just went straight through the middle of the hotel. And it killed people, of course. And it ended that hotel owner's ambitions of competing with the Rex. So Saigon was a very, very odd place. And I, you know, whenever you think of the Vietnam War, you see it in two ways. You remember the carnage, you remember the things you saw out of Saigon, and then you wonder whether you can believe what you saw when you came back. And I just remember in the morning you'd wake up to the sound of a girl singing on a loudspeaker in Lam Song Square. There were speakers all over the city chucking up propaganda. And there was this wonderful song, sung in this very high voice, and you woke up to it. It was almost like an early morning call, and you know, I'd get up and go across to the Continental Palace Hotel across Lam Song and have my pawpaw and boiled egg, and you'd listen to this music. And then if you'd been away to war that day and came back, you'd managed to get back that evening, you'd go to bed, you'd go back to sleep that night, and the same girl would be singing the song. And you had this odd sensation, has it really all happened today? You know, I'm going to bed to the same song as I woke up to. Have I really been out? And did I really see all that I saw today? Have I really done what I'd done today? Did I really almost get shot through the head or worse? There's this awful surrealism about Saigon. And that music, I've still got the copy of it, that music was the ultimate in surrealism. We talking about Tet earlier on, about what happened in Saigon, that for the Americans, the worst episode of Tet was in Hue, which was two-thirds way up the country towards up north. And it was the old imperial city, almost like the kind of forbidden city in Peking. Beautiful, beautiful city, beautiful buildings. During that Tet offensive, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong took it over. And there was something about American strategy that if you lost a place, you didn't kind of retreat and rethink and say, well, you know, do we really need it anyway? Is it that important strategically, tactically? Having lost it, it's a bit like taking a ball away from an American. You know, do anything to get it back, even if he doesn't really want it. And the Americans attacked Hue, and I think probably the most ferocious single battle of the war took place in Wei. It went on for just over 3 weeks, 24 days, and the bloodiest ground fighting, hand-to-hand, close combat fighting that ever was. There was a famous incident that appeared in a movie. I forgot, what was it called? Deep Metal Jacket, something like that. Metal Jacket, which shows a bit of the fighting in Wei reconstructed. And years later, just jumping on, years later, I met a blind North Vietnamese soldier who had fought in Wei